Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Think nothing ever happens where you live? Suburban Nightmare is a collection of stories that are hard to believe, except they really happened. And all in the streets and homes of the Australia many of us know and live. The suburbs. These cases range from recent murders to some historical stories that will shock and surprise. One of Australia's best young true crime writers, Emily Webb, probes the black underbelly of our towns and suburbs and exposes the darkness at the heart of Australian life. The book that we're featuring this evening is Suburban Nightmare, Australian True Crime Stories, with my special guest, journalist and author, Emily Webb. Thank you for agreeing to this interview and welcome back to the program, Emily Webb.
Thanks for having me, Dan. It's always a pleasure.
It is always a pleasure, and you've outdone yourself with this collection. As I just spoke to you, I was outraged with some of these stories because, as I had mentioned, Australia has a similar system, it seems, to the Canadian judicial system, as opposed in stark contrast with the American system. Congratulations on a fantastic collection here. Let's get right to this. Let's talk about a story that you title Mad and Dangerous, a killer named Kurt Dumas, and it starts off in September 1985 in Melbourne at a shopping center washroom, and a woman is at the stall and cleaning up in this shopping center washroom, and maybe you can tell us what happens from there.
Okay, so yeah, this is quite an unbelievable story. So this lady was in a shopping center that's on a main street in Melbourne. It's called Midtown Plaza, which is in Bourke Street. And so this was in the 1980s. She was in the washroom washing her hands, and suddenly she felt like a pain in her back. And she turned around and there was a man in the toilet and, staring at her. And she was absolutely terrified that he was about to rape her. And it turns out he'd shot her with a crossbow. Now, she managed to escape. He left. He got, spooked in a way from doing anything. But, yeah, so that happened, and that went unsolved for a while until this man actually committed a really, really awful crime and was arrested for it.
Now, you talk about Kurt Dumas meeting Lindell Martin, Miss Martin. They became friends, and they met at a Parkville adolescent unit. So they both had psychiatric issues, you say. So
yeah.
Tell us about this little meeting here, and where Dumas, they're friends, they haven't seen each other in a while, and Dumas is invited to Miss Martin's for dinner. So tell us a little bit how people discover that something went amiss at that dinner.
So basically, Kurt and Lindell had met, in this Parkville psychiatric facility. And they were both young. They were sort of like, late teenagers, early 20s when they'd met. And so they ran into each other, I guess, is how you describe it. And they're both living sort of in inner city areas in Melbourne. And Kurt had invited Lindell to come over and have dinner, whether or not I think they were in some ways romantically linked at one point, but yeah, stayed in contact. Right. And basically what happened is Kurt had invited Lindell over, and during the course of the night, don't know, we only have Kurt's version of what happened. He basically murdered Lindell, shot her with a crossbow, you know, as seems to be his weapon of choice, as in the first attack. And then more horrifyingly, as well as that, actually ended up raping her as she was dying. And she was basically, how it was found out that Lindell had died was Kurt's mother had gone round to his flat because he had fled. She'd been trying to get in contact with him. Now, there's a big history to him and his mum and his childhood, quite a disturbed childhood that I can go into in a bit as well. And she basically went to the flash and found Lindell's body covered under towels, and Kurt had gone missing a few days prior.
Now they find, they're looking for Dumas, and he flees to Tasmania and staying at a youth hostel, and that's where they arrest him. And as you write in the book, they find a crossbow, 10 arrows, some bullets, a pair of panties, a lock of Miss Martin's hair, a pair of handcuffs, masking tape, and a knife. And right from the beginning, he starts admitting certain things, and you write something that's, again, very amazing. He was speaking to someone, he was saying, well, she was still alive and resisting. And the police officer asked why he did that. And tell us what his response was to this question on why, about the, she was, tell us a little bit more about what you write in the book about this.
So basically, yeah, he'd gone on the run. So Tasmania, for those who don't know, is a state of Australia, but it's actually an island at the bottom of the country. So he would have had to, get a ferry. He'd actually also sort of made a bit of a flip to a country town called Oyen, and he'd actually been stopped in the course of that by a police officer. But yeah, he was actually sorry, I really apologize, my alerts are on my computer and I'm trying to turn them off, and I will get to that, but sorry for that noise interruption. I think the update did something to it. So basically he was actually arrested in Tasmania, and they found this, kit of stuff, and he, and that kit of, weaponry, and I guess a rape kit or a murder kit, you would call it, was part of what he did to Lindell, and she'd, and he bound her mouth, and basically said he got so angry that he fired the crossbow at her. When the police were like talking to her, he really he said that he was so distressed at her death he couldn't eat for days, and he denied actually raping her after he'd shot her with the crossbow. But basically, he'd said that tried to claim that, oh, that was sick, that he'd never do it. But, the police were quite shocked, basically, that that he'd done that. So it was quite sickening to the police who interviewed him.
Yes. Now, you talked about Kurt Dumas's mother, and she gave evidence at trial, obviously trying to mitigate the severity of his crimes and hence the sentence. But she did say that he had a severe head injury. So tell us a little bit what she said about his early life, these injuries, and other psychiatric contact that he had with authorities. So tell us a little bit about what she said at court.
Sure. So Kurt Dumas was actually born in America, so he's an American citizen. He was born in Michigan in 1965, and they had moved to Australia, I think when he was about 8 or something like that, but his mother had told the coroner's court, so that in the coronial inquest into Lindell's death, she told the coroner's court that her son had actually suffered a really severe head injury when he'd fallen from a table when he was only a little baby, about 3 months old. So I don't know what he was doing on a table. Maybe they were, changing his nappy or resting him there, whatever. I'm not sure. But she had said that since that accident, he'd had several brain operations. That was in America, and he actually had to have a plastic plate put into his head because there was fluid leaking in the brain. So I guess it was a shunt, you call it. And she told the inquest that the operation really changed her child. I mean, he I guess you don't really know what a baby's like when they're 3 months old, but he had grown into quite a violent, unpredictable child, and he had kept getting expelled from school because of his violent outbursts, and had had several stints in mental hospitals in Australia and the United States, because they'd sort of moved to Australia, then he returned to America and stayed with some family members for a little while, and then he returned to Australia. So he kind of flip-flopped around, and he actually had been caught in America when he was like probably a teenager. He'd actually been involved in an incident with two little girls who he'd basically almost really sexually assaulted. And so he was then sent to a child and family clinic for assessment. So he's quite, you know, he had a very checkered past. He was quite dangerous.
Absolutely. Now, in 96, finally the trial is in December 96, and by that time, again, he's despite the statements that he made unprovoked to police that would indicate this super blasé and casual attitude about what he did, and also to intimate guilt, at court it was a little bit different story, but they did have letters that were written to a work colleague that you say revealed the depths of his disordered and violent mind. What was some of the stuff that were written in those letters that he did to that work colleague?
I'm just getting to the book. I'm flipping through it as we speak. This is actually one of the cases, I think, that really got me going on writing another book. So I sort of felt quite, I don't know, shocked by it. But, yeah, it's almost like you want to put these things out of your mind sometimes when you so you don't have to think about it again. But you're right, he actually did write to a work colleague. He'd worked at it's like a factory that he'd worked with this colleague, and I think this colleague was named John. I'm just trying to find the actual exact reference. But it basically, when they were tendered as evidence, it was said by the judge that, you know, the letters provided graphic evidence that there was something very wrong with this applicant's mentality. So his friend was a man called John Beto, and they'd worked together at like a small goods factory, like, you know, that makes, you know, meats and salamis, things like that. And he actually gave evidence at the trial about a letter that Kurt Jamas had sent to him. And in that letter, quite sick, but Kurt Jamas had actually signed off as William Tell. That was his prison nickname, obviously because of the crossbow, you know, link. And, you know, in prison, I guess they're quite, you know, very, very dark humour with their kind of nicknames. So basically in this letter, John Beto gave the evidence and said that in the letter it was written, "I'm sorry what's happened. I didn't plan it. The chance was there and I took it. So John, I'm capable of killing someone and I'm not even feeling guilty. I'm not a mad killer." So that was, yeah, that was one of the things that, you know, was further grist for the mill for, you know, the evidence that Kurt was, you know, quite a calculated killer.
Now, with that, the court was convinced, he was convicted, he was sentenced to life, and I want to preface that with, very much like Canada, we spoke just before the program, it's not really a life sentence. It's not an actual
not
life
really.
Sentence. So he was sentenced to 18 years before parole eligibility, and then he got another sentence. Again, this is another thing we see in Canada, 3 years additionally, concurrently, which means nothing in real practical terms.
No.
And he was released.
Right,
exactly. And now he was released as early as he possibly could, you write, in 2003. Now,
you
think this story might be ending, so let's tell us what happens with Dumas when he ends up back in his home country of America, and back in Michigan. Tell us what happens after he gets out of prison and when he's back in Michigan.
Sure. So, he was released some time in 2003. Now, I'm not exactly sure. I couldn't find out And if anyone does know, I'd love to know. So I'm not sure if Kurt was actually deported, because in Australia they do have cause to, you know, if you have been born in another country and you may not be an Australian citizen. Like, we've had situations where people who'd emigrated as, you know, 10-pound POMs had come over, committed crimes, and then when they finish their sentence, they're actually deported back to their home. And that it doesn't matter if they've been a baby, you know, when they came to Australia and they hadn't become an Australian citizen, they get deported. So whether or not he was deported or whether he left of his own volition, I'm not sure, but he ends up back in America. Now, there is actually mention that he has a daughter who was living in Hawaii. Now, I'm not sure if this was a recent thing or if he'd fathered a child, you know, on when he was a teenager living in America. That stuff I couldn't find out. So he ends up back in America and he's living, you know, sort of working in some, you know, just blue-collar jobs, I guess. He's doing, you know, living in, renting a basement of a house from a woman whose name was Denise Ann Rock House, and she was in her mid-30s. And this was in the township of Redford in Wayne County. And so he was living in that basement. Mrs. House was separated from her husband, but she was in a new relationship with a man. You know, she had a boyfriend. So she had known Kurt through one of her jobs. So I don't exactly know how it came to be that he rented the basement. So what happened? So this is in December 2004. So, you know, a year and a bit after he gets released. And so the man called Todd Newman, who's in the relationship with Denise, is trying to contact her and he just can't get onto her. She hadn't shown up to her workplace. He'd driven by the house and her vehicle wasn't there, so she wasn't home, and he was just quite baffled. So basically what he did was he was driving around the streets and he spotted her car, which was a Jeep Cherokee, but she wasn't in the car. It was actually Kurt Jimas in the car, and he knew Kurt obviously because he was the boarder in the house. And he basically chased it down, chased the car down and blocked the car off in a sort of cul-de-sac, you know, where Kurt Jimas couldn't get out, and he called police basically. And so the police came and, you know, it was quite a suspicious situation. You know, Kurt Jimas had tried to, you know, evade the police, and, you know, the police officer who was first on the scene had written in his incident report that he approached the car, saw the man. This man was trying to rev the engine to get out of the ditch that he'd put himself into. And basically, so Kurt Jimas gets out of the car and they pat him down and, you know, look at his identity papers and find out who he is. So they're obviously very worried about Denise at this point. So Todd's beside himself, clearly. He can't find her. So they all go back to the house. And so two officers went to the house to check on her. And this was probably quite late at night at this stage, about 11 p.m. The house is in complete darkness. The keys to the house are in the car, so they use these to, you know, get in the house. First of all, they ring the doorbell, and then they, you know, Denise has got a dog, a very big dog, and it's barking like mad. So they wait for Todd, the boyfriend, to come to the house so he can calm the animal down, so, you know, so they don't want to get anyone injured. So they get in the house and they're calling out Denise's name and there's no answer. So they're moving around the house, and what happens is one of the officers goes into the bedroom and they find Denise on the bed. She had a towel over her midsection. Her clothes were pulled up. You know, she was naked from the waist down. There was blood, a large pool of blood near the side of her head, and she'd been bound. Sort of her arms were behind her back and she was dead. She had been killed. And, you know, what had happened was this was Kurt Jimas. He'd murdered her in a very scarily similar way to what he'd done in Melbourne, you know, all those years ago in the 1980s. So basically, he'd murdered again. He'd been let out and he'd murdered again in a very similar way. So these women just had no idea how dangerous he was. No one did. And I'm not sure whether that's because of lack of information sharing between countries. I don't have all those details, but I just find it quite shocking, you know, that he killed again. He was I don't know if he was being monitored when he went back to the United States because he'd been in jail in Australia. So these are sort of unanswered questions for me. But I did get quite a bit of information from the police in Redford County. They were very helpful with what they could give me under a Freedom of Information application. So that's how I got the details about what happened to Denise.
Yes, as you're right, Dumas, again at court, tried to portray things differently than reality, but in the end they realized that, and the outraged Mr. Newman, Todd Newman, publicly pressing for and outraged over that somehow or other he could have been convicted before and then to do this again, and he had found out that when his girlfriend was still alive, that Dumas removed her clothes and had sex with her, put duct tape on her mouth and her hands taped behind her. So, and when he denied premeditation, they did a computer check, and so at least it shows that the information that they had in Australia, again, was incredible that this person was ever let out of prison, that he wasn't given a life sentence. This idea that somebody could have been rehabilitated from the kinds of crimes, given his background, given what he had done, given everything that he had said about the crimes. Incredible. At least this time in America, he was sentenced to a minimum 43 years, maximum 80, and as you write, earliest parole date, 2049.
Yeah, and he'll be, dead by then. So, I mean, there's no real chance of him getting out. But he very, very mentally disturbed man, very dangerous man. And there has been a lot of publicity in Australia, Melbourne especially, in recent years because we have had some murders committed by people who were on parole and were not really being monitored closely enough. So now the parole conditions are extremely much, much tighter. So, for instance, there was a murder in 2012 of a young woman. She was Irish. She and her husband lived in Melbourne, called Jill Maher, and she was actually murdered by a man who was on parole. He was a rapist, and he was on parole, really hadn't been checked. And so that was really the case that blew open this whole issue of, whether parolees are being properly monitored, and that the fact that they're walking out on the street and a real danger to the community. So there's been an immense amount of publicity here. But in terms of, when they jail someone for life without possibility of parole, we do have prisoners in Australia who do have that sentence. In Victoria in particular, there are, I can think of at least probably 10 that have that sentence, but that, it's the worst of the worst, and they are deemed so dangerous that they can't be let out. But I mean, in my mind, Kurt Dumas would have fitted that bill. I thought he probably needs psychiatric help for the rest of his life, really, at least.
Yeah, I think that any judicial system that wants to take chances with killers is irresponsible. And when this sort of thing happens, not that you can bring anything back or convict these people of negligence in some way, but this demonstrates clearly why the U.S. system is at least superior in this one way, despite the best intentions, maybe even the reformed. Hopefully the killer would have changed in prison, but regardless, there's very little understanding in the community, and they listen to the community outrage to never let killers, or rarely let killers, ever out of prison. Some states are different, but certainly given all the circumstances with this Dumas, I cannot see how he was ever released the first time myself.
And it's interesting because it's a case that really hasn't had that much publicity. In fact, I think this might be the first time it's been written about at length. But the way I found out the link was I had come across the initial case where he'd murdered Lyndale Martin in the course of my crime research. And I, as you do, you file stuff, you like put it in a group of things and think that could be, that could be interesting to write about. I need to find out more. And it was when I was just, you know, as we do, surf the internet, you're typing things in. I found this link to Denise Howes, and then I, you know, did a little bit of, you know, tracking back, and that's when I found out that, yes, it was Kurt Dumas. And I, when I made the approach to the Redford County Police, I wanted to obviously be absolutely sure it was the same person, because you need to make sure. There could be two Kurt Dumases, you never know. But yeah, I was really, really shocked, because part of the documents, and there's a picture of it in the book that I got from the police, was the actual facts to Interpol to check whether, you know, about his prior convictions in Australia. And it ended up, yes, he was the same. It was the same one.
Particularly cinematic part of your of that story was when Kurt Dumas is the person that informs the police and a senior official at that, that, hey, listen, I've got a criminal record in Australia. So that official calls Interpol. He almost can't believe it. He can't believe it.
Yeah, that's right. He was shocked. I mean, when he was interviewed, Kurt Dumas was basically, he said, he was saying to the, I guess, the officer who was booking him in, he said, oh, how's jail? And the man, the officer responded, why is that? And he said, oh, you know, I'm guilty. I mean, he's clearly crazy as well, but quite calculating with it. And at this stage, they did not know about his violent past. And then, yeah, just a few hours later, I guess they would have found out from faxing Interpol. And, you know, during the police interview, he you know, obviously was talking about it and did mention that he'd been, you know, arrested for a, you know, arrested for a similar crime.
Yes.
Many years ago.
Now let's move on to, we're not going to cover all the stories, obviously, in this book, incredible collection, but I thought I picked out a few, four. And the next one, I think that it really is one of the most amazing ones in the book, is called The Ultimate Betrayal, The Murders of William and Pamela Waitman.
Yeah.
So let's go through this a little bit. I will say that in 1979, this couple adopted David. And,
yes.
And they went to immigrate to Sydney, Australia. And she had a sister named Margaret Irwin, and her husband was Alan. So tell us a little bit about who the Waitmans were and their life with David. What did it seem to the outside world, and the relationship she had with her sister and her brother-in-law? Tell us a little bit about their life before this tragic murder.
Sure. So, as you mentioned, Pamela and William, who was known as Bill, adopted David as a baby in England in 1979, and then they emigrated to Sydney when he was about 3 years old. And they settled into, you know, quite a nice life in Sydney. They ran a successful childcare centre. They lived in, you know, a nice part of Sydney, and really did give their son, you know, all the things that, you know, you would want to give a child. And so it seemed like a fairly, you know, good upbringing. And Pamela's was very close. The family were very close to her sister, Margaret, and Alan, who still lived in the UK, but I think they got together quite regularly. And yeah, so that was what life was like. And then it changed pretty tragically in January of the year 2000.
Tell us what happened that day, and how Pamela's sister got the information, the news. Tell us about that and the details of what she learned.
Okay, so what had happened is on the 9th of January 2000, a ranger was just doing a normal patrol of a national park in Sydney's southwest, and he noticed that there was a section of a mesh fence that had been broken, I guess, or was missing. And on investigation, he found a car it was on a fire service road, so quite out of the way, off the, you know, off the beaten track, as we say in Australia, off the beaten track of the main roads. And he actually found this car down an embankment, and there was two people inside, a man in the driver's seat and a woman in the passenger seat. So they were slumped over. The man was in the footwell and the woman was still secured by her seatbelt. And these people were identified as Bill and Pamela Waitman. And, you know, they'd been married a very long time. They were childhood sweethearts. And here they find them, they've died together. What happened then is Pamela's sister and her husband had to identify them. They were in Australia at the time. They attended the morgue. The night they were found, no one could find David, the son, to let him know what had happened to his parents. Obviously, they were very, very, you know, distressed and wanting to get in contact with him. And so they had to identify the bodies, and, you know, their bodies were quite badly bruised, and, you know, they looked like they'd been through a real ordeal. But basically what happened was, the coroner put it down to a car accident, and this just didn't sit well with Margaret Irwin. She thought this is not right. This is not how my parents died. My sister and her husband died. This just doesn't sit well with her. And basically, David seemed to be very detached when he was told the news. Like, oddly detached when he found out his parents had died, you know, not the expected reaction you'd have when you find out some awful news like this. And then that set really in motion this quest by Margaret and Alan, and it really overtook their lives. It actually broke their marriage up in the end, but they were dedicated to finding out what exactly happened to Bill and Pamela. And unfortunately, their suspicions were that it was someone very close to home that had killed them.
You talk about such a fascinating story, because they really did have a fight. You know, Alan and Margaret Irwin really fought against everybody, even the coroner's report, to say, listen, she didn't have the ring on her finger. She would have never left home without that. And Alan questioned why they were even driving in this park. And so what did happen was that he pushed and he pushed and he persisted. And finally, in 2001, as you write, there was a reexamination of the case. They couldn't really, they're not going to bring back the body because they were cremated. But the original coroner had to look at the information and realized his mistake. And so tell us a little bit about that mistake and his clarification of that mistake or correction of that mistake and what that led to.
Sure. So as you said, Margaret Irwin and her husband just kept pushing. They were pushing for people to reopen this. And in between, and amidst this, David, who had inherited all his parents' money, was, you know, living the life of Riley, traveling, you know, bought a house, all sorts of stuff, just living the high life. So what had happened was, eventually they did convince the coroner, whose name was a Dr. Kayla, to have another look at the case. So he brings up the original post-mortem file on his computer, and this is when he realised he's made a really awful mistake. So in his report, when he had said that Pamela Waitman, David's mother, had died of head injuries from the car crash, he'd actually been looking at autopsy results from another patient, and he typed an incorrect report number into the computer. You know what it's like. You hear it time and time again. Just one wrong number can mean the difference between, you know, a global financial crash or something like that. So he'd actually made this dreadful mistake and really botched the initial investigation. So the Irwins kept pushing and pushing. And during this time, they had really come to believe that David had killed his parents or arranged their death. So it was an incredibly, you know, traumatic time for them. But basically, the injuries on the Waitman's bodies just did not match up with the coroner's report. So Bill Waitman had bruises on his face, but they didn't match up with the steering wheel, you know, so that suggested that they'd happened before the car accident. He had other bruises on his body, and it actually, on re-examination, it actually looked like, you know, someone had held him down, like someone's knee was on his chest, those kind of bruises, or he'd been, you know, gripped or pinioned by another person. He had these bruises on his arms. So really, they couldn't be caused by a car crash. And Mrs. Waitman as well, Pamela, had also had bruising, similar bruising on her arms, on her legs, and there was also sedatives found in their bloodstream. So this new report really vindicated the Irwins with what they strongly believed, that Bill and Pamela were actually murdered. They weren't, you know, didn't have a car accident.
Now, as well, one of the most dramatic parts of this story is, you say there's increased suspicion from Margaret and Alan. At one time, right after the murder of her sister, they had brought him into the family and tried to carry on as normal, but their suspicion grew and grew and grew. And so at one point, Margaret asked him, and it's very dramatic. What does he say? How does she confront him? What does she actually say? How does he respond?
Sure. So, this took quite a few years. So this is now in 2004. So it's 4 years after they died, the couple. So they're still keeping David in the family fold. They're at a barbecue at their home. You know, it's Australian tradition, you know, a barbecue in summer in February. And basically they're pushing him. She's saying to David, all I want to hear from your mouth is what you did to my sister and her husband. And she claimed, you know, that David said Terry killed them. So Terry turns out to be a friend of his, sort of a loose association who became kind of close to him. And they hadn't been friends for long before the deaths, but they had bonded over a love of motorbikes. And this Terry Dene had actually done some work, for Bill and Pamela, like done a bit of driveway work for them. So basically when Margaret Irwin heard this, she, you know, ushered David away to a quiet spot and wanted to find out more. And she said that David told her, I killed them, I'm an asshole, basically. That's what he said. Sorry for using that language, but that's a direct quote. He finally cracked and revealed to her that he had killed his parents.
Now, they have a trial. There is obviously this Terry Dene. It's a back and forth. David testifies against Terry. What is in the end, what is the result of the trial?
So basically they're both in jail. Terry Dene actually got a longer sentence than David Waitman. So it's quite, you know, one of the things that really stuck in my mind about this case is, you know, the realization for Bill and Pamela that it was their own son who organized their murder. And there is, there was evidence that, you know, he was fighting for his life, Bill, but he was sedated. So he would have been obviously not been able to fight it off. And as soon as he found out, he just was like, you bastards. That's what he said to them. You know, he must have been, imagine that, just so shattered that, you know, his own son was involved in this. It just would have been horrifying. So basically, Terry Dene is going to be eligible for parole in 2039. So he's got a pretty long sentence. And David Waitman, his earliest parole date is actually 2026, so in 10 years. So they've been, there was a retrial, there was a few thwarted trials, but Terry Dene was found guilty at a 2012 retrial. They are going to be away for quite a while. And the Irwins, obviously just left devastated by the fact that their nephew, the child that her sister and brother-in-law had adopted and loved and given a really good life to, had done this. So, yeah, and I think the most telling quote I finished the chapter with was that Margaret Irwin had told a newspaper that her sister couldn't have her own children, and she was the happiest she'd ever been when they got David. And then you just have no idea that years later this baby will grow up to, you know, my child, my killer kind of thing. I think it's quite horrifying.
Yes, and why you call it the ultimate betrayal too is just to add even more horror to this, is that he was present when his mother was being killed, and then the killer,
yes,
Donné, came and said, "Listen, that was a lot of hard work. You know, it's a lot harder than you think, and I need help with your father." So there was evidence, at least it seemed, that he held down his father and killed his father because, geez, he wouldn't have wanted to go on without the mother. And super twisted logics.
Yeah, it's very sick. And it was, I think there's, you know, there's, I guess, questions about, you know, what heavy drug use does to you as well, because clearly he'd been a habitual user of marijuana and stuff like that. So, I mean, you know, it's no excuse, but you do wonder what all this stuff does to your perceptions and your thought processes.
We can't blame any external thing for this kind of behavior of holding your father down. Cannabis, I don't care what drug. There's no drug on earth that can excuse, even partially, any kind of behavior like that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to take this opportunity to talk about our sponsor today, which is Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories. If you listen to True Murder, you probably love true crime books and podcasts just like me. Now, there's a new podcast I love called Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories. It combines dramatic storytelling of a audiobook with the conversation and analysis of a true crime podcast to create a completely new audio experience. Unsolved Murders is different. It has a staff of screenwriters, an ensemble of voice actors, and a talented digital production team bringing cold cases to life. Very entertaining. They dramatize each episode almost like an audio movie. And at the end of each case, the hosts tell you who they believe committed the crime. It puts a modern twist on old-time radio. This is a true crime podcast with all the facts, and the cold cases are absolutely real. Check out cold cases like The Black Dahlia, Jack the Stripper, Mysterious Case of Edgar Allan Poe, or the first ever Hollywood murder of director William Taylor. Unsolved Murders comes out every Tuesday. Visit iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast directory and search for Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories. Again, that's Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories, or visit parcast.com/unsolved to start listening now. That's Parcast, parcast.com/unsolved to listen now. Unsolved Murders. Now, Emily, we talked about the ultimate betrayal and the incredible case of someone being released after murder to commit another murder. Let's jump to this case. Almost, this is incredible. I had no idea. This is one of the most shocking and unbelievable stories that I've ever read. Incredible. And you call it The Butcher of Wollongong and Mark Valera.
Yep.
This is amazing. In New South Wales, in June 1998, a housekeeper finds the body of 68-year-old Frank Arkell. And she had worked for his father or in the family. She had worked for him for 40 years. He has been bludgeoned to death, hit 34 times. Now, he's a former Lord Mayor of Wollongong, and he's a lifelong civil servant, worked in finance. He was a mayor from 1974 to 1991 and also elected independent member of New South Wales Upper House. And he was passionate about his city. Now, despite this, 7 years after his political career, tell us what happens, what is he linked with, and so tell us first about the murder itself. What police find, who finds the body, and then you can tell us a little bit about his very illustrious past.
Yeah, so you're right. So Wollongong is an area in New South Wales that's quite heavily industrial. Not as much so now, but it's home to BHP, which is the Broken Hill Petroleum Steelworks, so it's known as Steel City. So it's quite heavily industrial, but it's starting to change. So Frank Arkell was, you know, Mr. Wollongong, they used to call him. He was was the city. He was quite dedicated to it. His body was found by his housekeeper. He was 68 at the time. He was in the bedroom of his granny flat, which is like, I guess, what we call a, it's like a little bungalow, I guess, out the back of a property. And he, this housekeeper had worked for him for more than 40 years and lived a few doors down, so she knew him very well. He had been bludgeoned to death, so it was an absolutely brutal murder. You know, there's blood spattered everywhere. And so this crime did shock the city. But Frank was quite a controversial figure because several years before he had been linked, he'd been named in Parliament by a fellow member of Parliament. He'd been sort of linked to paedophilia. So there'd been a Wood Royal Commission into the New South Wales Police Service several years before. And basically his name had come up in the investigation because there was allegations of there being paedophile rings that were run by, you know, high-level people. So there was a cloud hanging over him. And to this day, obviously, no one knows, you know, if it was true or not that he was a paedophile. He was a lifelong bachelor. That doesn't necessarily mean anything, but often that can be a euphemism for maybe he was a man who, you know, a gay man. I don't know. But, yeah, he had been a controversial figure. But, yes, so he was found dead and it definitely shocked the city. And then there was more to come. So people wondered, was this because, you know, of what had happened with the Royal Commission, of the allegations? Was this a potential former victim of his that had done this? And then there was more shocks to come for the city.
Now, you talked about him being outed in Parliament, and that person's name was Miss Franca Arena. And she also named, and it's very interesting how the stories link in this book, a couple of the stories that we will talk about, this one and the next one, where she also names a former, and this is a very popular, again, you talked about Arkell being a popular person in his city. This is a popular judge, I guess, nationally, or at least this is a very popular judge, named David Yeldham. And mm-hmm. So this Miss Franca Arena names him as well. And then another former mayor apparently was a key player in this alleged pedophile ring, and his name was Bevan. And in his death in 91, you write, there was tape recordings and other communications and notes from customers and from the boys they abused were found, and it proved that Bevan had abused boys and then shared them with other men for a fee. And then days after Miss Arena's claims, former judge David Yeldham gassed himself in his car. And he said before he confessed to sex in public washrooms, but he denied having sex with minors. So this pedophile ring seems to be growing and more salacious contention all the time. Tell us what happens in the midst of all this next.
So basically, you're right, all those things that you mentioned, and David Yeldham was a very well-known judge in Australia. He'd actually presided over many very high-profile cases, and, you know, I did make it clear in the book that there was never any definitive linking of him with this. It was just that Franca Arena had named him, but he had lived, you know, he was a family man, but he had lived a private life of, you know, private homosexuality, I guess, and had, you know, he had admitted to the commission that he had paid men for sex and was bisexual, but never engaged, you know, in abusing minors. So it was actually, I guess, the shame of what had happened was probably too much for him, I guess, and that's what happened. So anyway, in the midst of all these 2 weeks, so Frank Arkell, that gets a lot of publicity, that murder. But what had happened was 2 weeks prior to that, another man in Wollongong had actually been murdered and mutilated. He was a shopkeeper. He was very popular. He had like a little, you know, like a milk bar kind of shop thing in Wollongong. And he had been murdered and mutilated in his suburban home. It was a suburb of Newcastle called Albion Park. And police were really, really reluctant to publicly link those two murders because they actually were very fearful that there was some sort of revenge killer out there, because Mr. O'Hearn was gay as well, but just very, you know, quietly so, you know, no word that he was involved in anything that Frank Arkell had been, you know, connected to. But the police thought, well, these men, you know, there's these links, and they were both brutally murdered. So the police were actually really worried, and they didn't want to get the city so scared that there was a killer on the loose.
Now, you talk about this guy was mutilated, but as you detail, his head was found in the sink. He had been disemboweled, mutilated his penis, cut off his left hand. A hammer was inserted in his rectum, and some of O'Hearn's bowel was left on a silver tray along with pieces of intestines. Satan was written in the victim's blood on the mirror and wall, and a pentagram, an inverted cross. And the killer, the killers used O'Hearn's severed hand to trace the bloody messages. Now, what the police feel, there's some connection with the Arkell murder, and they believe it's, again, it's some in revenge of some abuse. What is their idea, and how do they proceed in the investigation from there?
Yeah, so obviously they've got their, you know, their quiet suspicions that these could be linked, that yes, it could be possibly someone who had been abused and was exacting out revenge. But there was no real link between Frank Arkell and David O'Hearn, except that they were, you know, well-known and popular members of the community. So they've got these definite concerns about this. And there was another murder of another pedophile in Sydney, and they thought, oh, maybe that could be linked. It ended up they were not linked at all. But the brutality of the murders, I guess, got them extremely worried that this was someone wreaking revenge, basically. And you know, there were some people who, you know, offered up profiles thinking that this was probably a youngish man who was, you know, committing these murders. So they also concentrated their investigation into people who had an interest in Satanism and the occult because of that murder scene. It's about as horrific as you could ever hear about. And because of the, you know, Satanism written on the wall, they started to look into people in the area who had had an interest. And that actually led them to a man called Keith Schreiber. And he actually didn't live that far from Mr. O'Hearn. So they are thinking, oh, okay, maybe he's good for this murder. And they knocked on the door. Keith Schreiber's flatmate answered, and his name was Mark Valera, but at the time his name was Mark Van Creevel. He changed his name, and he was 19, and he spoke with the police, and he let them have a look around the place, let them look inside his flatmate Keith's bedroom. You know, they saw some satanic inspired music posters, pretty, you know, disturbing hand sketches that depicted beheadings and things. So they were starting to think, wow, this could be the guy. However, Keith Schreiber actually had a very solid alibi for the time of the murders. So the police are now just, you know, on high alert. They really need to find this killer because they are very, very frightened that he will kill again. So they're basically appealing to the public after this for information, and this drew out some pretty solid tips for them from someone, including a woman, who said her ex-boyfriend wore clothes that were very similar to the ones that the offender had been seen wearing, which were basically, you know, boots and Nike track pants. And they had been found at the murder scene at Frank Arkell's, and they were not obviously in keeping with any of the other things that Mr. Arkell's clothes were, like the shoes were a different size, and, you know, he didn't wear Nike tracksuit pants, so they thought that these must have been the killer's clothing.
Yeah, and the girlfriend went on to say that the boyfriend was fascinated with the murder and became aggressive when she questioned him about the bloody clothes that were shown on TV.
That's
and
right.
As a result of that, Mark Valera surrendered himself, as you write, as the killer of Mr. Arkell and O'Hearn. And he had confessed, apparently, to his Taekwondo instructor, and they went to police. And it was a 20-hour interview where he confessed. Tell us about what Valera said in that 20-hour interview, which was incredible.
Yeah, it's pretty pretty scary. They'd actually found what was really frightening for police when they're very lucky that they got that he handed himself in, because it turns out that Valera was fashioning himself into becoming a serial killer. Like, he'd made notes in a book called The A to Z of Serial Killers, and he'd written notes in that book. That was some key evidence. You know, he'd written a list of people that he'd wanted to kill, and that did also indicate that people who were gay were on his hit list. So these men were targeted really for no more reason than they were gay. Frank Arkell, obviously very high profile, and because it was it's a smaller city, not the size of Sydney, people knew where Frank Arkell lived, you know, that kind of thing. So it wasn't like he was not accessible, I guess. So
right.
What was really disturbing is that he told the police that on the day he killed Mr. O'Hearn, who was the shopkeeper, who was, you know, a very quiet man, went about his business privately, his reasoning basically was that he just wanted to kill someone, and it was just a random attack. So he'd seen Mr. O'Hearn by sight when he was walking around the neighbourhood, and really that was all it took for him to target him, which was really frightening. And he said that, "I had it in my mind that I just wanted to kill someone that day."
Yeah, that was an incredible. At least people got that bit of closure as to the motive for this incredible crime, despite what the media had sort of more than intimated. Now, the thing is that he said he had, at the trial, however, of course, Valera claimed provocation as a defense, didn't he?
Yes, he did. So particularly in the case of Mr. O'Hearn, and this must have been incredibly distressing for his family, Valera tried to claim that Mr. O'Hearn had tried to, you know, come onto him, I guess, and put him on the spot and ask for sex, which was absolutely not the case at all. Like, the forensics proved that, but that was his, basically, one of his defences, that's why he killed Mr. O'Hearn in self-defence. But, you know, it came out in the trial that Mark Valera had, a pretty horrible childhood. No excuse, but these things do get taken into account during trials, as you'd know from, you know, Canadian trials. But he'd actually also claimed that he'd been sexually abused by his father as well. And this was apparently a real shock to people who had known the family. He'd never before mentioned this. So that was also brought up in the court case.
Now, you even have the father goes on the stand to deny that there was any of this abuse. And then just when we think we're going to wrap up a story, he gets life without parole. And then 10 days later, tell us what happens 10 days later.
Okay, so, well, you're right. So Mark Valera gets sentenced to life in prison, and he is actually never to be released. So he's one of those prisoners in Australia who will never be released. And he was the youngest person in the country, or in New South Wales, the state where Wollongong is, to get that sentence. But yeah, so he's in jail. So 10 days after that sentence, his father's murdered. So Jack Van Creevel is murdered. What happened is, it's even, you couldn't think this story could get worse, but basically the killer was Keith Schreiber, who was his flatmate and also the boyfriend of Mark Valera's sister, Belinda Van Creevel. So she had convinced Keith Schreiber to carry out this murder, and it was brutal in the extreme, where Mr. Van Creevel was, you know, almost decapitated. And she was 20 at the time, Belinda, and she'd basically been the mastermind of this. She'd claimed that the father had also sexually abused her for years, and had even started to turn his attention to her young daughter. And basically she told this to Keith Schreiber and said that, you know, you need to kill him. You know, he was killed with a fire poker, a knife and a tomahawk. And Belinda Van Creebel and her little daughter were actually in the house as their father was killed. And apparently Keith Schreiber told police that when he killed Mr. Van Creebel, he did it for his friend Mark, who was in jail. And he said, I told Mr. Van Creebel, this is from Mark, you bleep, used an expletive, pedophile expletive, you'll never molest another kid again. So Belinda had sort of, you know, said to Keith, you know, this is what's happened. You've got to, like, avenge what's happened to Mark, kill my dad. This is the reason why it's all happened. And she's actually sort of known, she's quite notorious in Australia. She's actually was the inspiration for a film that was made called Suburban Mayhem. It was like a black comedy about a manipulative teenage mother who gets her boyfriend, who's pretty stupid, to murder her father as she sits in the next room. So she, she is a bit notorious in Australian circles. She is out of jail and they dubbed her Belinda, like Evil Van Creevel. So, yeah, you couldn't think it would get any worse, but it did. So this family certainly very, very disturbed.
Again, disturbing sentence. Schreiber gets 12 years minimum. Again, I guess it's a life mm-hmm. sentence with 12 years parole eligibility minimum. And she gets 6 years for soliciting
yeah.
the murder. So.
Yeah.
Scary sentences, scary stories, scary killers, scary sentences. And, you know, to add even more horror to this story, we're not finished yet. Belinda and Mark win $300,000 from her father's estate.
That's right.
And then in 2013...
No one else to leave it to.
Yes. In 2013, you write, too, that she attacks her boyfriend, stabbing him 5 times, and winds up 3 years in prison.
She
Tell
does.
Us about
so she
this,
was with her.
Sorry?
Yeah, I can tell you about that. Tell it about that, Kate, about when she attacked the boyfriend. Is that what you want me to talk
sure.
about?
Well,
sure.
And also the 60-minute interview that was very,
sure.
very, very interesting.
Sure. So 60 Minutes, it's similar to, you know, the American version. It's one of our, you know, current affairs shows. So, yeah, Belinda, she's out. She's with a man called Marshall Gould, and she attacks him. She basically stabs him during an argument. And he's still very protective of her. So he tells the police that he's been mugged and attacked by 3 men. But obviously when the police search the couple's home, they find a bloodstain, and he basically tells the reporters when she was sentenced that he still loves her and he supports her, and it's because she's had a troubled childhood. Now they're not together now, so she does her jail sentence. And further fuel to the fire of Belinda being quite a notorious woman, it was reported in a newspaper called the Daily Telegraph that she whispered to her boyfriend, if anyone asks why you're sticking with me, tell them it's because I'm sexy. And that was, one of those salacious details of this case. And so when she was released from prison in 2015, she gives this exclusive interview to 60 Minutes. And the reporter, you know, says to her, well, can people feel safe with you out in the community again? And she sort of smiles and says, oh, why not? And it's described that in one of the most dramatic moments of the interview, so the reporter hands Belinda the book that her brother had written his, like, killing list in, the A to Z of serial killers. And that had the handwritten list of his intended victims. And she'd never seen this book before up close, apparently. And written on the hit list was her name. And so she looks really shocked in the interview, but then quickly brushes it aside and says, well, that's just him being angry. So there's this very odd, I guess, sibling bond between them, that defies all the things that have happened.
Yes, fascinating, fascinating. Now, we have time for one more story, and this
sure.
is another amazing one called The Killer Down the Street, Debbie Keegan Murder. And you open with a very dramatic scene. Basically, there's a crowd outside a courtroom yelling, kill him, to a man who, towards a man who had murdered and raped a little girl.
Mm.
And you also include a 18 months before this date in 1987, another rape, but far worse. Tell us about, as you do in this, introduce this story, the killer down the street and the crowd outside the courtroom asking for someone's head.
Sure. So this case was from the mid-1980s. It was 1987. And there is a very stark photo in the newspaper report. It's this lone policeman trying to hold back this crowd who are basically baying for the blood of this offender who is being driven to court, you know, in the back of the police wagon. And, you know, they're basically chanting, kill him, kill him. So they're at Blacktown Court, which is in Sydney's outer west. And, you know, that's a bit of, it's always been known as a bit of a hard scrabble area. So real working class, really, some pockets of real, I guess, social deprivation, but yeah, they're very, very, they all gathered and they were just, yeah, wanting this guy to be killed. The reason they were also so upset was because 18 months before, there had been the murder of a young nurse called Anita Cobby. And this case remains still one of the most shocking cases in Australian history. It absolutely horrified the country. And Anita had been abducted on her way home from work one night by a gang of men. Some of them were teenagers, actually, and they had, it's very disturbing. They had basically, you know, gang raped her and murdered her in the most brutal fashion. So that community and Australia was really still reeling from that. So what had happened with this particular murder in 1987 was of a little girl called Debbie Keegan, and she was 9 years old. And what had happened is, she lived in a suburb called Tregear, which is kind of in the Mount Druitt area of that area of Sydney. So yeah, very, quite a battler suburb, I guess you'd describe it at the time. And so she had been murdered in her house. Someone had got into the house and basically raped and suffocated her. And it wasn't discovered till the morning by her mother. So that just absolutely, you know, devastated, New South Wales again and Australia.
Yes, you aptly described this in vivid detail. And this mother had been separated from her husband, and she had four little girls living in a house. And when she woke up in the morning after she put the kids to bed, Debbie was sleeping with her sister, Sarah, which was seven.
Yep.
And when the mother came to wake them in the morning, her daughter was unresponsive, and then she discovered the brutality, the savage murder, and also that the window had been open. And
yeah.
But anyway, that's the outrage in the community is obviously natural. But the police didn't find any forced entry, so they have to speculate that they knew the family. But there was something that had happened on the night that Debbie was killed next door. So tell us what police thought about that possible connection from that break and enter that same night.
Sure. So, yeah, on the same night that Debbie was killed, there had been a burglary at the house next door to Debbie's house. And a video recorder had been stolen. So the neighbour had woken up at about 4 a.m. To feed her baby, and she'd seen her front door and lounge room window wide open. Now, you know, back then, simpler time, you know, maybe people didn't lock their houses as much as they do now, but the police just found it quite interesting that this had happened on the same night that Debbie had murdered. So they were trying to work out if it was connected or if it was just a coincidence. And there was no sign of forced entry to Debbie's home. So yeah, that led police to believe that the killer knew the family, or they possibly knew the family situation, that there wasn't like an adult male in the house at the time. So obviously they might feel, you know, it was easier to commit a crime. So, yeah, they think that possibly the killer just really walked in the door. You know, Debbie's mum had fallen asleep in the in front of the TV. We've all done that before. And, yeah, the killer had possibly got in the house.
Now, 2 days after, while, the community's reeling and the police are running around trying to look for suspects, 2 days after, a 17-month-old was abducted in Liverpool. And the person who took him also, in that case, stole the video camera. Now, that baby was found, but there was an attempted sexual assault. You take it from there that now we're at the funeral for Debbie.
Yep.
And tell us what happens at this funeral.
So obviously there's like more than 100 people at the funeral. Very emotional. The media were there. And on the cover of the service booklet, Debbie used to do little tapestries, and they had a picture of the tapestry she'd done when she was 6 years old. So it's just heartbreaking, you know, the innocence of that matched with the, you know, how she died. And during the funeral, so all the media are there. There was a handwritten note that was basically thrown into a television van parked near the cemetery. So they obviously handed the letter to detectives, and the note was written in three different colours of pen and had quite a few spelling mistakes. And this letter writer claimed that the killer was known to the Keegan family and was actually at her funeral service. So, look, the funeral was widely covered in the newspapers. And the letter also made mention of another case in 1987, prior to Debbie's murder as well. A little girl had been killed in her house while she was helping to set the dinner table. Someone had driven past the house and basically fired into like a drive-by shooting. Her name was Tess DeBrincat, and she was 5 years old. And that was another very, very high profile case, and it hit, people were absolutely appalled, and it really called into question, you know, the violence around Western Sydney. What was the government doing about it? So basically what had happened was it actually never really, a lot of the charges got dropped against these people, but it was apparently a, some sort of payback, I guess, against Tess's father, who was allegedly having a feud with one of the people who had been arrested for shooting. So it was a really, really horrible, horrible story of a little innocent girl like Debbie being murdered. So, yeah, so that happened. They didn't really work anything out more from the note, but it did gave them stronger cause to believe that, yeah, the killer was going to be close by. It wasn't someone who travelled from out of the area and committed the crime.
As I mentioned before, what's interesting is that that person that was convicted of manslaughter in that shooting of that child was, again, life, but served only 12 years, and he was sentenced by Judge David Yeldham from the previous story. Now,
that's right, yeah,
Now, you jump to the police have or get a suspect for Debbie's death, and it's Rodney Thomas Clark.
Yeah.
How do they come to he become a suspect, and once they have him, once they question him, what does he do?
He basically confesses. So they'd interviewed him a few days after the killing, because they'd obviously gone around and canvassed the area and interviewed lots of people. And then again, a week later, he went to the police station, the local police station, which was Mount Druitt Police Station. He went voluntarily. So he was a 21-year-old. He lived with his parents and his younger brothers in the same street. And in this police interview, he admitted he killed Debbie. So he told them he climbed in the back window to get access to the house. He just walked through the house. Noticed that Debbie's mum was asleep, and he claimed that Debbie had disturbed him, like whether or not he was there to rob the house. But then he claimed that he put his hand over her mouth and he didn't mean to kill her. But then obviously police are questioning him about, she was sexually assaulted. And it basically turned out that it was while this was happening, she'd been suffocated because he was like holding her head down into a pillow. So it's just the most awful thing. Like, yeah, and that's how she died.
There was a back and forth, too, of course, to mitigate his sentence. Of course, why not? They found him borderline mentally retarded, but he was sobbing in court, as you report. His family was supporting him all the way, and they talked about his history of drugs and alcohol. At first, he had said he was not alone, but later admitted that that was a lie. And there was some attempt in appeal court to say that this was opportunistic and not that he had intended to kill. However, tell us about this, how the authorities find something that's contrary to that, a list.
So is this the, is this when he gets, it's the appeal for the sentence or the initial sentence? I'm just trying to remember the...
Well, what I'm talking about is that he provides, that someone provides a long list of sexual fantasies with where he mentions abducting underage girls.
Yeah, that's right. So he basically had talked about that, and it was in, I think, in offender. So he's in jail. He's attending something called a custody-based intensive treatment program, which when people undergo that, I guess it goes more favorably in their, you know, it's more favorable to them when they want to go for parole. And he basically admitted in that his offences were not opportunistic, as he, you know, said at the time of his arrest. So he'd revealed during this program that he'd actually had, as you said, a long history of these kind of fantasies with a violent theme, underage girls, and he knew Debbie. He'd seen her around and he'd had thoughts of abducting her. So it shows the premeditation there, not that he just strolled into the house, you know, just on a whim and was, you know, disturbed by her, you know, while he was trying to rob something.
Certainly. Now, again, the most horrifying part of these stories, I think, is the judge thought, despite all of this, that this guy should be eligible for parole.
Yes,
public
this isn't...
have to say about this?
Well, the public did not like it and does not like it because he is eligible to apply for parole again next year. So, you know, one of the justices in the appeal said that, you know, because his family has stood by him and they believe that with continued counselling and his family's support, his mother's still around, his father had died, that he could possibly establish a law-abiding lifestyle in the community. I'm not sure about that. But basically, yes, this has not gone down well. And I think the most horrifying thing is every time this comes up for Debbie's family, it reopens the wounds. So what... as well as public outrage with people like calling in talkback radio, some people had actually also started petitions. So, you know, online petitions are very popular now. So last year, a woman started a petition to lobby for his parole to be denied. Lots and lots of people, hundreds of people have signed it. And, you know, people, you know, leave messages about how the crimes impacted them. And basically the thoughts are that, you know, he's a monster, you need to keep him behind bars. So, look, he is actually, he's up for parole next year. Whether or not he gets it is another story, but I guess it's his legal right to do that. But, yes, there are questions about whether you'd really want him living in your street or not if he gets out.
It's incredible to me that the parole board ignores the public, ignores the family's intentions, and then seems to compartmentalize the behavior of this killer and confine it only to the behavior in prison in a controlled setting with these so-called rehabilitative programs. Now, I believe in rehabilitation. I just don't believe in rehabilitation for these people at all whatsoever. And the horror of a family and friends having to make an online campaign every 2 years like they do in Canada, the same thing. We have thank God it's popular, but again, it takes this incredible effort to get these people which are unlikely to get parole. And there are high-profile cases in Canada like Paul Bernardo and Robert Picton that will never get out. And there would be an incredible outrage if they were ever considered to be out. But despite that, there is still slim possibility, and that's why it is so good to have a provision of parole, of a life sentence without the possibility of parole. These stories illustrate that and demonstrate that.
That's right. And you really, I mean, for Debbie's family, you know, her sisters are adults. They've grown up without their sister. I mean, I've got two children myself. I can't even imagine what it would like to be lived through this. But I do believe in rehabilitation as well. But in certain cases like this, you've got a question, you know, would you be able to not act out on your fantasies or, you know, the fact that you've killed a child before? I mean, how can you really be let out in society? That would be my question.
No, there's no, I see no need in no demand to risk, even if it's a slim risk, a statistically small risk, regardless, and put the family through anything more than murder and a court case. And in some of these cases, the victim's families have to go pursue and hound the courts, and then hear a court-appointed defense lawyer lie for their client. I know they're just doing their job, but lie for their client in, again, the most outrageous, offensive ways, to denying what this perpetrator has already admitted. Incredible.
That's right. And, you know, you've got to think of when, if indeed, you know, they've got great family support, and I'm sure that does go a long way for offenders when they come out to rehabilitate. But what happens when the parents aren't around? You know, they've died because they're elderly. These people are, you know, left without support. I just don't really see, without absolute scrutiny and supervision, you could really prevent them from doing something. I don't know. This case, Debbie's case, is just so horrible, and that's why I included it in the book, because it just seemed outrageous to me that, you know, he is eligible for parole. And it did, it really, really hurt that community. They were already hurting from the previous murder of Anita Cobby. It shocked them, and they were the spotlight was put on them as a community, and they're really just, you know, pretty down-to-earth people, you know, working-class people looking out for the community. And it really, I guess it really shocked them that this could happen.
Well, I think the best supervision is, you know, an 8x10 cage. And that's guaranteed that they're being monitored and supervised forever. I want to thank you, Emily, for coming on and talking about this latest suburban nightmare, Australian true crime stories. For those that might want to find out a little bit more about your work, or do you have a website and do you do Facebook? Let us help.
I do.
Let us know how we can contact you.
I will. I'd love to let you know. I have a Facebook page called Emily Webb Books. So you can look that up. I have a website called Emily Webb Crime, which just details the stuff I've done. And for North American listeners, the book is available on ebook. It's not available in hard copy unless you want to order it and pay the postage, but it's just had its print run in Australia, but it's certainly available by ebook. And I do have a lot of readers overseas who get the books that way. So I'd really love to get some feedback if you want to talk to me about anything. But yeah, if you go over and like my page, that'd be great. I also have a blog that I've been doing for a number of years called True Crime Reader. I just review true crime books, and there's a Facebook page for that. So that's just that's another avenue to contact me.
Well, thank you very much, Emily. It has been an absolute pleasure talking about Suburban Nightmare. I know I will be speaking to you again fairly soon. Thank you very much for this, and good night.
Thanks, Dan.
Good night.
Good night.
Do you like true crime or mystery podcasts, movies, and TV shows? Well, let me recommend a podcast I love called Unsolved Murders: True Crime Stories. With the help of an ensemble cast of voice actors, follow hosts Wendy and Carter as they take you on an entertaining journey through real crime scenes and attempt to solve the case. Listen now on your favorite podcast directory or by visiting Parcast.com/unsolved. That's spelled Parcast, Parcast.com/unsolved. Good night.